I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I am sitting in the studio with a book in my hand called One of These Days by Trent D. Hudley. And I'm pretty excited about this book, not only because it's a collection of short stories, and I love short stories, but because it's written by a former student of ours, one who graduated the MFA program here in creative writing, the bilingual program, I think 2009, 2010, several years ago. Well, he just came out with his first book, and I'm very excited to talk to him. As a professor of creative writing, one of the most rewarding aspects of the job, I don't even like calling it a job, I think it's more of a calling. One of the most rewarding parts is when your students go on to produce great work. And Trent has become a friend of mine, and I'm so glad he got his first book out because this is a voice that really wants to be heard and, well, needs to be heard. So stick around and we'll talk to our former student, now a professor himself, Trent D. Hudley. Trent D. Hudley is a professor of English in Colorado. He teaches creative writing and English and composition and literature, and he is actually a former student of ours. He got his MFA in creative writing here at the University of Texas in El Paso, and so I got to know him, and we became pretty good friends. This is his first book of stories. He has done all kinds of jobs, including writing sports for the Denver Post. He was a janitor, a kitchen manager, a painter, a cashier. But now he is among the writers with his first book, One of These Days. Trent D. Hudley, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Trent, you were a student here in the bilingual creative writing program, the MFA program, years ago, which is how I knew you. But I've never known what D stands for. Trent D. Hudley. What does the D stand for?
DeVell.
DeVell. I was going to guess Daryl.
All kinds of jokes surrounding that. You know.
Oh, DeVell, like the devil, like, oh,
yeah,
you're evil.
Especially when I was growing up, yeah.
Well, you know, I've been dipping into One of These Days, your new book of short stories put out by Valise Press, and there are a couple of little evil moments in this. So there's a little duende in this.
It shows spots, doesn't it?
Yeah. You have a lot of characters who go to bars. I'm reminded of a quote by Andres Montoya, the poet. He says, in a poem, I tried loving once, but I ended up punching everybody. Tell us a little bit about how this book came about.
Well, really, it was it's a lot of older stories and so forth that I've been working on throughout the over the years and so forth and so on. But the ones that I chose for this seem to have this fascination with the uncertainty and the aspect of the possibility of hope, I guess, lack of a better. So that's sort of where I was coming from with these stories. The newer one that I wrote right before the book was published is Nothing That Is Not the Moon. Is, you know, that's kind of revolves around some things that, you know, that are, I won't say complete autobiographical, but experiences that are really going on in my life right now. So.
Oh, and that story is really, I mean, when you get past, there's a lot of, shall we say, Kundera type of narrative commentary going into that story. But when we really get down to the basics of it, it's about a young man and his relationship with his father.
That's part of it, right? That's actually one of the experiences or the essences that the narrator encounters, right? He's dealing with this aspect of his father's. That's partly autobiographical in that sense, but also more so than just the actual situations. Because at the end, you know, it's not the happiest story of any of them. Right. Really, but,
I don't think any of these are very happy.
Right. But there's also there's this sense of hope that permeates. And
sense that the characters want to continue to hope.
Right, right, exactly. And at the end of that story, there's this sort of the idea that, you know, nothing's being done, but I hope that the reader at the end of the story is still hopeful. Does that make sense?
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
So I don't want to throw out, you know, that sort of, I can't get rid of this sort of the dark, right?
Right.
That's a lot of the theme that goes on, and I think we have to face that dark and several levels.
Right.
And that's where this groups of stories are coming from, is facing that darkness, whatever that manifestation that is.
You know, that's interesting, because I'm thinking, as you talk about facing the darkness, I'm thinking of Cormac McCarthy, and even to use a more popular culture reference, is that series on Netflix called Black Mirror. My fiance won't watch it. She says it's too depressing. But you do retain, I would even say, faith.
Yeah, definitely. I don't see hope as being, you know, like where, you know, I'm hoping I get to, I win the lottery. You know, there's a possibility for real change, right? Whether that person is going to, or we as a species or whatever, right, is going to actually embrace the possibility of change is one thing, right? But still, but it's always there. That's my idea of hope, and that it is a real quantifiable possibility.
That's nice. I think you need to retain that. You know, I'm a runner. All right, actually, I should say I'm a jogger, because
right.
I probably couldn't keep up with real runners. But and I try to treat it as a spiritual practice. And so I try not to blast music into my head, but I use that time to meditate as I'm running and moving. And the other day, I started thinking about this idea of faith and hope. And I spent, I think, the entire run trying to distinguish between faith and hope. And I think what I came up with is that hope is specific, even almost material. You know, you hope to get the new job, you hope to make it home by dinner time, but faith is a more widespread net around the whole concept of everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Do you think your characters are hopeful or faithful?
Well, so like my conception of, I think it's kind of different than yours in that faith is something that's vacuous, right? I mean, it's a possibility, right? Not a probability.
Right.
Maybe I'm getting that backwards. But hope, there is something about the idea that things will change if particular actions are taken, right? So, I mean, it may seem like right now, for an example, a person is rife with addiction, right? They're depressed. They have this, you know, dark outlook, but there is that possibility. They may have faith, but faith doesn't take action. That's possibly where I'm coming from. Faith doesn't take action. To have hope is to act upon that, right? Faith is sort of just, it's there. You have it, and you're wishing, whereas hope signifies a particular type of action that needs to be taken, I guess, to achieve that. The goal of that hope, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And maybe even on some level, we're talking about the same thing because, you know, I'm saying that hope is, there's a material aspect of hope.
Right.
You know, whereas faith is...
Okay, right, you know, right.
You know, you hope to win the lottery.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. But you have to buy a lottery ticket.
Right.
I'm talking to Trent D. Hudley, author of a new collection of stories called One of These Days. What is interesting about a lot of these stories is, and I think this is somehow connected to faith, there's this idea that there is a reality that perhaps isn't perceived by everybody on a day-to-day basis, and this reality could be just as real as, you know, what most people perceive to be reality. There might really be demons out there. There might really be the walking dead. There might really be some other realm that we, you know, maybe sense, but can't really always access. And I'm wondering if, well, first of all, would you say that's a legitimate comment to make about some of the musings in this book?
Whether there is like there's a separate reality?
Yeah, there's a reality that we can't see. There's another world, perhaps a world of spirits or the world of, you know, something other than just the material reality.
The fantastic. Yes, I don't know if I necessarily wholehearted believe in that, but I think what's the fantastic that is everyday life, not so much as in what goes unnoticed, right?
Uh-huh.
I was trying to exemplify this in the first story, right? I mean, we have these categories, and the armadillos surround the courtyard, right? We have these categories. We have this particular way of seeing the world in which it works for us, right? But that's not necessarily the way that the world works.
Right.
There are, even outside of our scientific knowledge, there's just things we just don't know, right? And I don't know if there's just that's really magical in a sense, or, I mean, besides being metaphorical about it.
Right.
It is very wondrous, you know, there's things. And that's what keeps me thriving, right? There's things that we don't know yet, and things that fall outside of our normal everyday perceptions in our that are natural, that are part of the natural world, but that we just don't perceive or cannot perceive as a species, right?
Right.
You know, it's another metaphor, the way we perceive our reality, right? There are things outside of our reality that exist that we're not, and we can't just dismiss them because we can't understand them yet, or we have not, we're not perceived them completely and so forth and so on.
Right. And
does
you
that
know,
make sense?
Yeah. And the fact that you mentioned science, and I'm kind of, you know, mentioning a little bit of the spiritual realm or other realms, I think makes a lot of sense, because I think both mystics, mystics who are the, you know, the physicists of religion in a sense, and physicists who are the physicists of science or the mystics of, of science basically say the same thing, that, you know, what we perceive, there's 99% of reality we don't perceive. We perceive 1%. And whether you want to call that science or, you know, or spirituality, the fact is, your characters oftentimes live in and out of this world. You have a character who is doing a jackhammer. He's on a jackhammer, and he loves the way that jackhammer feels. And later on, he goes to a bar, and he basically turns into the Incredible Hulk. He starts to to beat people, and he, you know, and I love that image of him just breaking through the wall of the bar and running through the city. But that couldn't happen in the 1%.
Right. Exactly. And that 99% is where hope lies. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
To me? I mean, to, that's my my idea of hope, right? So there are things that we not yet comprehend, and in comprehending those things, there is a great possibility that things will change.
Right.
And I don't think that that's just wishful thinking. I think that there's an actual possibility of that happening if we take certain steps.
Right, absolutely. Earlier, you used the word chose when you talked about the stories that made it into this book. And to choose stories to put into this book implies that there were a lot that didn't go into the book.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, did you choose the stories according to a particular theme or according to the language or character? Or how did you choose the stories? Were there thematic connections?
Yeah, so there was some hardcore realist stories. They're a little violent, and towards the end, my publishers helped me get a better, more concise theme that the book has now, right? But my original goal was a couple of stories that just didn't fit, and I was kind of arguing with them about that, because I wanted the stories, but now I see where they're coming from too, you know. So I'm kind of glad they didn't include those stories. But
who did you work with? Did you work with Lau or Minerva or both?
Both.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah, fantastic. Yes.
Yeah, I imagine it'd be quite a pleasure working with them. You were a graduate student when Lau was around, weren't you?
Right, we were together, and I graduated, I think, maybe a year or two before her. She came in after.
Right.
I came in 2006. She may have came in 2008, I believe.
And now she's the publisher of Valise Books. How did this book come about? Did she contact you? Like, she remembered your stories and your passion?
No, I contacted her. I was, I think I was on Facebook, and I saw Jeff Sirkin's book.
Uh-huh.
And I looked, you know, and then I looked up the publisher. Like, wow, this is, wow, maybe I can, you know, send this to her. And she obviously liked it, so.
How long ago did you graduate from our program?
2009.
And have you been writing all that time?
To be honest, I was dabbling, and this book was a sort of act of desperation, because I'm kind of caught up in a situation that I don't really want to go into. But anyway,
I want to go into it. Nah, just kidding.
Oh, okay,
just kidding.
You know, I'm the adjunct stuff. You know, so I mean, right. it's not the most promising career. So I was really just kind of like, you know, I'm not gonna. After this, I'm not going to try. I'm like, you know, I was in that kind of state of desperation. I'm like, I'm not going to write anymore, and it's not, you know, it's not working, forth and so on. So, and she didn't know any of this, but I was, you know, I sent this out, and it's like, all right, this is my last chance. I'm like, last try. I'm not going to. After this, if it doesn't work, it's just not going to, you know, it's not going to try it anymore. And lo and behold, and you know, so now I'm back into it. And so now I as before, I mean, before I didn't, you know, I was in this kind of funk. But now I am. I write regularly, daily. Nice. So.
You know, there's a quote that I encountered rereading Joseph Campbell's A Hero of a Thousand Faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes, he says, there's a benign protecting power of destiny. And
I like that.
If you're a writer, you know that there's some benign protecting power that keeps you a writer, even when you try to give up.
Right.
Hey, so I'm curious, as I was reading this, I felt a lot of presence of the antepasados, of our ancestors, even the ancestors that are still alive or just, you know, aren't really ancestors, you know, died a few years ago. And I'm wondering if you could tell me who you think your major influences are that manifest themselves in this book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Kafka. It sounds so ludicrous to come out of my mouth, you know, try to not necessarily compare it. But yeah, Kafka-type stories, you know, the magical realist, you know, the Latin American writers, Cortázar, Marquez, and so forth, those Borges, mm-hmm. and even some of the science fiction writers, you know, like Ray Bradbury and so forth, like that, stuff like that. I don't know if I was consciously trying to achieve that, but
well, I don't think we need to be conscious of our ancestors and our day to day creative acts.
Right.
So you know, I mean, I think an act of creativity is going to be influenced by them, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was reading Nothing That Is Not the Moon, I don't know if you ever read this story, but if you haven't, I would try it. But there's a story about Kafka called Descriptions of a Struggle, and it's In Prague, they have a statue of Kafka on the shoulders of this big guy, and that's an image that they took from that story. But it's really an interesting story, and I felt that during this Nothing That Is Not the Moon, not necessarily that you were emulating the story or had even read it, but that you kind of channeled a little bit of the after image, we can call it, since you use that term in the story, of Kafka, that his spirit was in that work.
Man, I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, that's like a huge compliment. You know what I mean? Even it's just kind of overwhelming to think about. But I've never read the story. But if it works on that level, I mean, that's more than I could even imagine, you know, when writing it. But yeah.
Well, you know what Kafka does is he's able to get away with just about anything.
But he's Kafka.
no matter how irreal he is.
Right.
And he doesn't do it by magic. He does it through language. And if you and if you were to, you know, look really deeply into his work, Description of the Struggle is a great one to study, because in that one, the character begins to project his desires on the landscape. So, for example, there's a particular passage where he says, "I wanted there to be a moon, and there was a moon."
Nice.
You know, and I wanted there to be mountains, and there were mountains. It's like the landscape is starting to be created based on his will. And, you know, and I see a lot of that in your work. You have these characters who, or these stories that aren't necessarily straightforward. Here's what happened. I think the one about the guy in the jackhammer.
Force of Nature.
Force of Nature is probably the most straightforward story here in terms of the language. But a lot of times the language gets caught up in philosophizing or thinking.
Right.
And that gives a somewhat of a blur to the landscape itself, and that blur allows you to get away with things that might be a little bit irreal or Kafkaesque.
Right. So, I've never really looked at it that way, yeah.
I'm talking to Trent D. Hudley, a former MFA graduate from the University of Texas in El Paso. I think did you have any classes with me?
Yeah, you come on, man. You were my mentor. That hurts. That hurts.
No, I just I just wanted you to say, they were the greatest classes I've ever taken.
See, I think one that we had was physics. One class I remember particularly was
The physics class.
Physics and literature, yeah.
Yeah, where we took the metaphors of physics and played with them.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. And I think Jose was in that class, and he's a physicist. He goes by, I think his nom de plume is Joseph Avesky, yes. But his name's Jose Palacios. He's from Colombia, and he just came out with a couple of books, one of them that just won a pretty good prize. He was in that class. A lot of good people were in that class. Veronica Guajardo was in that class. And I'm wondering, in this book of in this collection, are there any stories that began when you were a student in the MFA?
That is so funny you should ask that. I was just as I was going through the book, you know, again recently. I wrote "Hail to the Bus Driver," the bus driver man, in the very first class that I took in the program. From Luis Ramos.
Right, who just recently retired.
Oh, he did? Yeah. I didn't know that. He was a fun guy, yeah.
I miss him, but I got his office, so I don't miss him that much. Just kidding, Luis, if you're listening.
Yeah, that was one of the stories. That was actually a later story that I didn't include it in the original manuscript when I sent it out, but two of the stories that I said, La Minerva didn't think would fit in the book. They took those out, and I used this story. You know, I revamped it and revised it and so forth. But it seems to fit very well, and you know, still has that sort of irreality to it. Right.
And who are you reading right now? What fiction writers are you reading right now that are inspiring you to write another book?
My favorite, you remember? I think I may have turned you on to him. Wonderful, fantastic, and I can go on and on. Haruki Murakami.
Right.
I'm reading. I have not his new work. I'm plowing through. I shouldn't say plowing through. I am skipping through, I guess, for lack of a better term, through 1Q84.
That's like it, 1,500 pages.
Yeah, it's like 900 some pages.
Yeah, you need two people to carry it.
Right, exactly. So I'm involved in that right now.
Wow.
But short stories. I'm actually, as I was sitting here. Waiting for your call, is I'm reading a short story by Anthony Doerr, I believe his last name is, D-O-E-R-R.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Shell Collector, and it's extremely good.
Wow. I'll have to check that out.
The collection of the short story, The Shell Collector, but I'm reading the title story right now. So.
Right. Are you, I like to ask new writers this, you know, those who just came out with their first book. Are you surprised or challenged by the amount of work that has to go into having a book? I mean, we think of the work writing the book, and it is, but then once you have the book published, you got to get off your butt and do something about it. How are you handling that?
I am overwhelmed with that. Like you said, the book itself is a lot of work, right? You know, the daily work of writing and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And I think we had this conversation before. You know, ideally, you put your book, you write your book, it gets published, and you move on to the next thing. Because sometimes it's boring to me. I don't necessarily really like doing readings. I'll do them, but reading the same stories over and over, I'm just like. I guess what a musician would feel on a concert, you know, doing it the same songs over and over and over. And I really just want to kind of, you know, just leave this one behind and start on
right. But you can't.
But ideally, and of course you can't, right? Because it's not, I don't know if it's ever really been that way, you know, but.
I think it probably was less that way 50 years ago than it is now, because now there are literally millions, and this is not an exaggeration, of books published every year in the United States. And before it might have, 10,000 at the most?
Right. So, yeah, there's that's unexpected, and at times it's a little inconvenient, you know, where you have to go out and you have to, lack of a better term, peddle your book. I'm not that type of person. I don't really necessarily, you know, enjoy it. It's not something I completely dislike, but it's, you know, I'd rather just sit and do the writing itself, anybody, like any other writer. But yeah, so I was a little surprised and and it is challenging, you know, booking readings and so forth and so on. And
Yeah, and you know, the whole concept of the book tour has shifted even in the last, since I started here at UTEP in the year 2000. The concept of the book tour has shifted. It used to be something sponsored by the publisher. And the publisher mm-hmm. would put you on a plane and send you to this city and that city and put you in this hotel and that hotel. And even though that exists for a very small group of writers, now when writers talk about the book tour, they're talking about they set up readings in this city and that city, and they're doing it on their own.
Right, exactly. And that takes a lot of time. You know, it takes a lot of work.
And money.
And effort. And money, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's, a lot of writers aren't making money off their work, but they're actually spending money to be writers.
Right, exactly.
But why do we do it, Trent? Why do we do it? Why don't we just, you know, why don't we just say the heck with it? Give me that jackhammer.
That's a great question. I have fun when I do it. Uh-huh. I guess it's part of that that realm of hope.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and but what I'm actually hoping for, it's not real clear. It's that act itself. When as a writer, when you are involved in that act, when you really get in that zone, you know, when your book is carrying, is being sort of relayed to you by whatever force that is, you know, your imagination, your muse, whatever you like to name it, right? It's that moment when you feel, I don't know, for lack of a word, connected to what? I don't know. It's just, I feel, Zadie Smith, I was watching probably the dreaded name, Charlie Rose now, right? Uh-huh. He was doing an interview with Zadie Smith, and one of the things she said that stuck with me is, I am the best person that I can be when I'm writing. That's why I do it.
That's nice. Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that comment. I'm probably the best person I can be when I'm writing.
There's a sincerity to the act, yeah. You know, to a letting go, right? Of not trying to be in control, you know. And it's a pleasurable and it's scary at times, you know.
Yeah.
Is this any? What the hell am I saying? You know, how do This is trash. Who the hell do I think I am? You
yeah.
know? But that's that sensor, you know, that once you get rid of that sensor and you're involved in that act, right? That work, it's work, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is essential, at least to a part of my being, and I think most writers would agree.
Well said, Mr. Hudley. I'd like to thank Trent D. Hudley for joining me on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is One of These Days. Good luck with this, Trent, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you again.
I'd like to thank, once again, Trent Hudley for joining me on Words on a Wire. I just love talking to former students. Actually, I just love talking to writers. And, you know, I love talking to cashiers and waiters and lawyers and doctors, and I just love talking to everybody. And I would love to thank our producer, Lauren Tarrazas, and I'd like to thank you for joining us, and see you next week. I'm Daniel Chacon.